Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is away this week. Coming up, a specialist on international law says the U.S. committed war crimes in Libya. And an historian says blacks sided with the British in the American Revolution, and with good reason. But first, President Bush always claimed that he had the right to use preventive detention to imprison without charge or trial people he labeled terrorists or associates of terrorists. But Bush never pushed through legislation that would codify those powers. Now, such legislation has passed the Congress with the assistance of the White House. At the Occupy Washington, D.C. encampment at Freedom Plaza, we spoke with organizer Dr. Margaret Flowers, who says protesters have good reason to be worried about preventive detention.
Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA analyst and did the presidential intelligence briefing for 16 years, believes that this provision is a direct response to the Occupy movement, and it enables the definition of a terrorist to be very loosely defined. It allows indefinite detention, and it allows our U.S. troops to be used on U.S. soil against people. So it's something that does concern us, and we're further marching into a militarized state.
Would that signal that the rule of law has ceased to exist in this country?
Correct, and it's something that has been withering for some time now. The rule of law only applies to the 99%. If you're up in the 1%, then you're able to get away with, you know, all kinds of things. And, you know, we've been seeing our country march in this direction for a while. We see the building of more prisons and detention centers inside the United States, the privatization of our prison system. We know that there's been significant recruiting of people to work in these new, you know, detention centers, these new prisons, to be expanding homeland security. We're seeing our state police forces with all kinds of tools and weapons that, you know, are very scary things, these huge vehicles that they have and towers and all kinds of tools that we would normally see used in combat zones, not on U.S. soil.
The Occupy movement, and of course many others among progressives in the United States, seeks to forge ties with movements abroad that oppose governments that may be supported by the United States. Under this new regime or this emerging regime, does that leave Occupy and others open to being charged with giving substantial support to enemies of the United States?
That's definitely a possibility. You know, we saw that Occupy London was actually determined by the London police to be a terrorist organization. And the Occupy movement in the United States does communicate with other democratic movements, revolutionary movements around the world, because we're all fighting the same thing. We're fighting these neoliberal policies that funnel wealth to the top and oppress, you know, the rest of us economically through loss of jobs, education, healthcare, things like that. So, yes, it is a possibility. The Occupy movement is a worldwide movement.
And the Occupy movement is forging ties with, for example, organizations and peoples in Egypt.
We communicate with a number of different countries, and we coordinate international days of action, but we've been recently particularly concerned about what's happening in Egypt, as the peaceful protesters there have been really treated very brutally, many deaths as a result of them asking for the ability to have a civilian government. They want the military government to step down and allow them to have a civilian government.
Having been to some extent inspired by the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement has a moral stake in what goes on in Egypt.
That's true. And in addition to that, we're very concerned that the U.S. is providing tear gas and weapons that are being used against the people of Egypt. And this is just not unusual of U.S. imperial activities to help suppress democratically elected governments or suppress the ability to have a democratically elected government.
As an individual, did you envision in 2008 that Barack Obama would be a president who signed and possibly encouraged the passage of preventive detention?
You know, there were many people around me who saw it. Personally, I was trying to believe after the years of Bush that things would actually get better. And what we're seeing is that this is the system, this is the country that we live in. And right now, it doesn't matter who gets put into that system. The policies have been laid out long ago. The direction that we're going was laid out long ago. And, you know, one towards controlling our population and, you know, really looting our country for the top 1%. And that's what has sparked Occupy movement. And I'm glad that I saw it and that more and more people are beginning to see it, because it's going to take all of us working together to change what's happening here in this country.
So we've got a new year for Occupy, which is only 4 months old.
That's right, and it's come a long way in those 4 months, and it's continuing to grow. What we're organizing for right now with occupations all around the country is what we're calling Now DC. It's the National Occupation of Washington, D.C., which begins on March 30th. We're asking people to start arriving in the city. We'll have a few weeks of teach-ins and workshops focusing on things that people can do back in their home communities to weaken the pillars that support this current power structure, and then we'll be having direct action as part of that event as well.
Dr. Margaret Flowers at the Occupation in Freedom Plaza in Washington. In New York City, it's expected that police will have stopped and frisked 700,000 people on the streets, the vast majority of them black and Latino men. The practice has been under legal challenge for years on constitutional grounds, but this year, activists have confronted police on the streets and at police precincts, leading to scores of arrests. Carl Dix explains how the Stop, Stop and Frisk campaign got started.
We called a strategy session in the summer around mass incarceration because we thought that people like Michelle Alexander were exactly correct, that this was a new system of social control. It was not the result of criminal activity on the part of the people who ended up in jail, but in effect, the criminalization of the demographics of people who end up in jail, and that it needed to be fought. Now, mainly who ends up in jail are blacks and Latinos. At this point, it's mainly black and Latino males, but there's the fastest growing section of the prison population is actually black and Latino females, percentage-wise, in terms of their growth. So taking on this issue was taking on an issue of particular concern to black and Latino people. But we were taking it up because it was a horrific injustice and one that we felt needed to be gone at. And our approach to it was we were going to go into the communities that were targeted by this, but we were also going to go other places because everybody needs to stand up and say, I'm not with this injustice, because it is in effect being done in everybody's name. And you can't just stand on the side and say, I got nothing to do with it. We decided to go at Stop and Frisk because we saw that as the pipeline to racially targeted mass incarceration. You know, the 2.4 million people, three quarters of whom are black or brown, who end up in prison, the reasons they end up in prison. And it starts very early to get put on a track to go there by the fact that their jobs disappear from the black and Latino communities, by the fact that the education system is geared to fail those youth. So we decided we were going to go at that injustice, but in particular, we were going to go everywhere to bring forward all those who could be one to stand against it. It's not surprising that a lot of the makeup of the people who came around this were people who lived it every day and had really reached the point where they didn't want to go on living it, and we're ready to put something on the line around it. But we also, as Occupy Wall Street developed, we made a conscious decision, we're going to go there. And we actually had to argue that one out, you know, because some of the brothers and sisters were kind of like, that's a bunch of white folks. What do they know about Stop and Frisk? Why would they care about it? And I agreed with them. Yeah, they probably don't know about Stop and Frisk, but they ought to know. And then once they know, they should want to do something about it because it's unjust. And it was a rocky road, especially at the beginning, because people didn't know about how the police operate. It was helped along by the cops going down and pepper spraying people from Occupy Wall Street who were just standing on the street corner not doing anything wrong. And with some persistence, we were able to bring to some folks down there that one instance that they got hit with that outraged them is a taste of how the police operate all the doggone time in the ghettos and barrios across this country, and that stop and frisk is in particular the way that they initiate that with a lot of people here in New York City. So that's where the grouping of people who have made up the core of the Stop, Stop, and Frisk campaign that we initiated out of the network to stop mass incarceration came from. And the way we see going forward with it is continuing to go into the communities that are targeted with this. We ended up accidentally running into a couple of sisters whose kids had just been harassed by the police and one of them arrested. And now they have joined with us and we're doing regular activity in their neighborhood. And we're going to target their precinct in January. But we're also going to do a citywide student day. And right now the core of the students who are going to do that are from Columbia University. And it's two sisters who are actually from Africa, Ethiopia, I believe, but from East Africa, who are spearheading this. And they actually have a very important take on it because they understand that they are on a track to not have to put up as much with that kind of stuff as most black people. But they reject taking that route because they feel like if you can do this to my brother or my sister, you're doing it to me. And then also on the real, when the cops step to you on the street, they don't know whether you're from Colombia or not. They just look at the color of the skin and act accordingly. And we've seen that in a number of cases of police murder. So that's how we go at it. And we're going to continue going at it that way. And this actually relates to part of what I think needs to happen in relation to Occupy Wall Street, you know, because I dialogue with Cornel West, and this was one of the big questions that came up. What about Occupy Wall Street? And I was real clear, Occupy Wall Street represents a very important positive phenomenon. People standing up, resisting, and questioning things. I'm always with that. And I don't start from, well, I don't like the demographic, because I ain't mad at somebody based upon who they happen to be and what their background is. I'm going to take to them what needs to happen and check to them what's really going on and challenge them to do something about the injustice that's involved in it. And that needs to keep happening in relation to Occupy Wall Street. Because I always tell people on this point about trying to represent the interest of the 99% against the 1%, you have to look beyond your own immediate circumstance to do that correctly. You can't say if you happen to be white and middle class that the only thing we need to deal with is the fact that more college students are running into trouble finding a job, having trouble paying off their college loans. That's part of the problems that this capitalist system brings down on people. But you also got to deal with the way they unleash the police in the ghettos and barrios to suppress and control people. You also have to deal with the way they come at the immigrant population. And then you have to see the 99% in a global perspective. And that's a challenge that I have consistently brought in relation to Occupy Wall Street. And one other thing that we're posing to the Occupy movement right now is that it has to come out strong in the coming year. You know, we're going to be coming out strong as far as the campaign to stop, stop, and frisk. We're going to be taking that to Occupy Wall Street. But Occupy Wall Street, in its own right, has got to come out strong because they've been hit with attempted suppression, military-style attacks, and evictions. But they're also being invited into the killing embrace of the Democratic Party, which if you're trying to battle the dominant interest involved in Wall Street, getting with the Democratic Party is like falling in love with the enemy from the other, you know, just another face of the enemy.
You call it the killing embrace. Do you mean such an embrace would kill the movement?
Yes, it would. I mean, look, we saw this happen in 2008 when you had all of these people who were very upset with what the Bush regime represented in terms of the wars for empire, in terms of the stuff coming down on immigrants, on black people, on women in this country. But all of it got swept up into Obama mania. with people putting their hopes for changes in the U.S. and in the world into Obama, when there was really no basis for that. Because if you listen to the man, he was applying to head the empire up and making the argument that he was the best leader for the empire. And if you look at this empire and its track record, the guy who's saying he's the best leader for the empire isn't the guy who's going to represent your interests. And that message is going to come back with a twist in 2012. And the twist is going to be, well, you've had 3-4 years of Obama. He hasn't delivered on those things that you thought he would do, ending the wars, getting rid of indefinite detention and all the repressive stuff around the world and in this country, reining in the police in terms of how they operate. In fact, all of that stuff's been stepped up. But they're going to say, but the other guy is worse. And I think my answer to that is they're both worse, because what they both want to do is lead the empire, and their argument is over which of them is best poised to do that. And if the empire is a program in the aiming to lead the empire in the best way for its interest, actually comes down to the interest. I mean, and the 1% is not scientific, but people are at least in the right direction in saying that there's a small handful of people whose interests are what determine how this country operates. The Democrats, Republicans, both represent the interest of that small handful of people. So getting hugged up with that is getting caught up in a killing embrace, and I'm going to be talking with people about not going out like that.
Carl Dix of Stop, Stop and Frisk. Not far from Manhattan in Newark, New Jersey, the People's Organization for Progress, POP, demonstrated on Christmas Day, which was no different than any other day since June, when POP began daily actions for jobs, housing, education, justice, and peace. More than 100 local unions, churches, and community groups have joined POP's campaign, including the anti-violence coalition Enough is Enough, founded by Minister Thomas Ellis.
Especially in the holiday seasons now, people don't have money, they don't have a job. More times than not, they are more apt to resort to crime. And so getting people jobs and fighting for jobs for people in the community is one of the issues that we will stand with POP with. But more than that, not just a job, but jobs at a living wage. I know this Saturday I was down there speaking on the microphone, and one of the major pieces I was trying to get to the people is the working poor. You know, we have so many people who are the working poor, which means they have a job. But if their job is not paying them enough money at a living wage, then that can create a lot of hardship. You know, if people have, you know, the $5 an hour job, don't cut it no more. It's hard to pay your bills on $5 an hour. It's hard to meet the needs of your family on $5 an hour. It's hard to pay your rent on $5 an hour. So jobs at a living wage, which means if people work, they need to get a salary that they can live off of. The war in Iraq is over now, but POP stood up against the war before the war started in Iraq. And Enough is Enough Coalition stood with POP right there on Broad and Market Street back in March, I guess 2003, whenever the war started, that we were standing with them before the war, and we stood with them after the U.S. dropped the Moab bomb on the people in Iraq, the mother of all bombs, which that bomb, one bomb itself was millions of dollars. And so with all the shock and awe that the United States was dropping on the Iraqis, people wasn't looking at the cost of all of those bombs and missiles. And so there's millions of dollars that was being wasted over there in Iraq. And one of the issues that POP was standing against was that war in Iraq. And so we stand with them for that. Now, again, Enough is Enough is an anti-guns and violence organization. And many times in the community, we see people being shot, people being killed, people being robbed, carjacked, and that's something that needs to be addressed. And so it takes courage to stand up for others. I say this all the time. It takes a lot of courage to stand up for those many who will not stand up for themselves. But it takes even more courage to stand up for others. And so one of the great things with POP, again, is that they don't mind standing up against police brutality. Well, police brutality is a major issue in the community. And so we stand with POP against police brutality because we understand that it's not right for somebody if they get apprehended for hypothetically a loose joint or open beer. And by the time they get to the precinct, they beat down, if they make it to the precinct. You know, sometimes these cats, the cops arrest them, not all the time, but when they get to the precinct, they all beat down, and sometimes many never make it to the precinct. There needs to be people who's willing to stand up against that. And so we join POP in their efforts, standing up, fighting for the rights of people. You know, we know that our people should have justice instead of injustice. Our people should have equality instead of inequality, and we all should live in peace. But a lot of times that's not happening. So People's Organization for Progress is an organization that is not afraid to raise those issues, but more than raising the issue, actually try to come up with some sort of resolve or solution for the betterment of the community, but more than that, for the betterment of the people.
So the Enough is Enough Coalition opposes violence within the black community, but also violence against the black community and U.S. violence against other people in the world.
That's right. Matter of fact, we oppose violence all over because we are about humanity. So when people are being abused, no matter if it's by the hands of a gun, if it's by the hands of a police officer, or if it's a domestic situation, we are against that because we know that violence begets violence. And in today's society, nothing good comes out of people shooting people over an argument, something that could have been probably resolved with a little thought. Conflict resolution. A lot of times our people need conflict resolution, anger management. But more than that, I've attended thousands of wakes and funerals and spoke at wakes and funerals for young people, middle-aged people, and adults who had their life just taken away because somebody wasn't thinking. And so, yes, when you're talking about violence, we will stand and we're against violence in the military. I'm a veteran. And I understand that the country has to be safe and protected, but we also understand that violence inflicts pain. And so even in the holiday season, we do a dinner every year for family members whose loved ones were murdered. And POP is one of our major supporters on that. Every year, if your loved one was here last Thanksgiving and they're not here this Thanksgiving, that family is in pain. They're hurting. Christmas time, people are celebrating the holidays now. And so just imagine if a three-year-old who last year his father was here, but this year, during the course of the year, during the summer, his father may have got murdered. Well, that three-year-old has a void. And so we as a community have to step in and fill that void. So we are really glad that we can help to meet the needs of the people right where they are. And that's one of the reasons why we support POP, because in trying to help to meet the needs of the people right where they are.
Minister Thomas Ellis, Christmas was day 182 of the People's Organization for Progress demonstrations. POP promises to keep up the protests for 381 days, the duration of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. This year, the United States and its NATO allies waged a seven-month bombardment campaign against Libya, launching 7,700 bomb and missile attacks that hit scores of cities and towns. But NATO's commanders claim that in all those explosions, they killed not one civilian. They can make that incredible claim because NATO policy is not to acknowledge that civilians have been killed unless it is confirmed by NATO investigation. But NATO's policy is never to investigate civilian deaths, so it is guaranteed that the number is zero. This would seem to be a war crime, since under international law, combatants are required to avoid killing civilians and to take care of those that are harmed. We spoke with Dr. Francis Boyle, the noted professor of international law at the University of Illinois in Champaign. He said, yes, the U.S. and its NATO allies have committed war crimes against civilians in Libya.
Let me quote for you paragraph 216 of the U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10, the Law of Land Warfare, which is still valid in the field today. The U.S. government still considers itself to be bound by it. And it says, quote, at all times, and particularly after an engagement, parties to the conflict shall, without delay, take all possible measures to search for and collect the wounded and sick, to protect them against pillage and ill treatment, to ensure their adequate care, and to search for the dead and prevent their being despoiled. That language is taken from Article 15 of the Geneva Convention on the Wounded and Sick, and my guess is all the NATO states are parties to that treaty as well. So there is an obligation, certainly, to go out and search for wounded and sick, and also the dead, but it doesn't look like NATO really cares. I believe they took the same position after the bombing of Serbia, where there, too, they underestimated, I think, significantly the amount and extent of casualties of that bombing.
And this, in fact, was not an underestimation. These are declarations from the head of NATO that no
right.
one was killed based upon a policy of not investigating, period, a civilian death. So wouldn't that seem to indicate a policy that is in contravention of
The Geneva Conventions, right, which is a war crime. To violate the Geneva Conventions is a war crime. There's no question about it. And this clearly was an international armed conflict between all the NATO states and Libya that triggered the entirety of the four Geneva Conventions of 1949. So basically NATO, which is really the U.S., has indicated it doesn't care about the Geneva Conventions.
As a matter of policy. Also, it appears that the United States is anxious to conduct air wars and engage in conflicts in which it doesn't have to set boots on the ground and will therefore not be an occupying, in the physical sense, an occupying power, and possibly escape the laws of war by not setting foot on the soil of those that it's killing.
That is correct, Glenn. It does appear the statements coming out of Washington now is, as far as they see it, Libya was such a great success that it should serve as a template for the future, although we know for a fact there were U.S. armed forces on the ground in Libya, special forces for sure, and others there to target the bombing. But they arguably were not there as an occupying force under the laws of war. And although the laws of war would apply, it would not trigger the laws of belligerent occupation and arguably the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. So it might give them more legal protection just doing the bombing than actually doing the invading. Please understand, I'm not trying to justify any of these reprehensible policies. As you know, I opposed the war against Libya from the get-go and still do. We still have no idea precisely what the casualties are over there. You know, figures go from maybe 30,000 dead up to 50,000 dead and still counting. And I don't know if we ever will get a realistic figure by anyone. Certainly the current authorities in Libya are not interested in providing such an investigation and information. And all the Western NGOs were complicit in the NATO attack on Libya.
Well, we do know some civilians that were killed by NATO bombing. We know that Colonel Gaddafi's youngest son and three grandchildren.
That is correct. Clearly, the attempt by NATO to target Gaddafi and the immediate members of his family were an international crime. There is the 1973 New York Diplomats Convention that specifically protects heads of state, such as Gaddafi and his family members. So there's no question about that. I'm just talking about the large-scale 30 to 50,000 number. We're just going to have a lot more investigations over there to be able to look at the circumstances surrounding these deaths. But the whole thing, in my mind, appears to be a prima facie Nuremberg crime against peace and crime against humanity. There's no question about that.
The United States seems intent upon muddying the rules of law. In this new age in which the United States can carry out massive attacks through drones and aircraft without having substantial forces on the ground, in support of other proxy forces on the ground, isn't the United States liable if it provides close air support for the civilian casualties that are inflicted by those proxy forces that it is supporting?
Well, sure, we're facilitating what they're doing, and it has attempted to redefine the well-recognized rules of international law with respect to international armed conflict, and basically to justify in a retroactive basis crimes that they have already committed. But so far, it doesn't appear that the rest of the world has gone along with this. There was an attempt made to come up with a new set of the Geneva Conventions to justify so-called counter-terrorist warfare, and that failed. It does not appear the rest of the world is going along with it.
Unless, of course, the rest of the world is NATO.
Well, that is correct. It does appear that in the Libya operation that the member states of NATO, and remember, not all of NATO participated in this, in the conduct of the conflict itself, but it does appear to be now a retrograde step where we're seeing these NATO states engage in wholesale slaughter of the Libyans from the air.
Professor Francis Boyle, speaking from Champaign, Illinois. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston and one of the most prolific black public intellectuals in the country. His newest book is titled Negroes of the Crown. Dr. Horn says the American Revolution of 1776 was in reality a white settler rebellion to perpetuate slavery. Most black slaves knew that and favored the British side in the rebellion.
There are different trends that take place in the writing of history. That is to say, even though the basic facts may not change, but our interpretations change. And our interpretations oftentimes change because the needs of different generations change. Look at W.E.B. Du Bois and his book on Black Reconstruction, which upended the then reigning interpretation of that period following the U.S. Civil War, i.e. 1865 to 1876, and which theretofore had been seen as an era of Negro corruption and misdeeds and all the rest, and Du Bois put it in the exact opposite way. And I think that we're well overdue for a reinterpretation of the history of the United States, because a lot of the basic narrative really doesn't make any sense. What I mean is, if this was such a grand revolution, as it has been taught to us, even by so-called progressive historians, then how did it end up so badly as a Leviathan? Why did conditions for the enslaved population actually worsen after the rebels defeated the British? Why did it take until 1965 for basic voting rights to be validated after this so-called grand revolution? And I think as well, because of the rise of China, which I think is going to shake the psyche and the confidence of the U.S. elite, and I might also say the U.S. population as a whole, there's going to be a groping for a new interpretation that fits the current conditions. And I think this is where my book comes in. Because basically what I say in this book is that the revolt against British rule was basically a successful revolt of racist settlers. That is to say that it was akin to Rhodesia in 1965, assuming that Ian Smith and his cabal had triumphed. It was akin to the revolt of the French settlers in Algeria, North Africa, in the 1950s and the 1960s, assuming that those French settlers had triumphed. And just as it would have been difficult for Rhodesia or French Algeria to construct a progressive republic after a racist revolt, it was very difficult to construct a progressive republic in North America after what was basically a racist revolt. Now, the book at hand, of course, deals with a number of episodes where I show that the Africans were basically not on board with the revolt against British rule, not least because the revolt in British rule against British rule was motivated in no small part by the fact that abolitionism was growing in London and was thought in North America to be on course to spread to the entire British Empire. This is one of the many reasons why you had more Africans by an order of magnitude who fought against the rebels in 1776 than fought alongside the rebels. And this is why the War of 1812, whose bicentennial will be marked within a few weeks, that is to say in 2012, the War of 1812 was probably witnessed the longest and most sustained period of unrest by enslaved Africans in the history of the United States, even though this may come as a surprise to many people who study history for a living. You may recall that it was in August 1814 that the Redcoats took the torch to Washington, D.C. You may not know that there were Negroes and Redcoats who were present in great numbers. You may know that one of the reasons why Washington, that is to say the United States, had such difficulty in defeating the British in that war was because they always had to worry about their backside. That is to say, if they sent their so-called white troops out to confront the British, they had to worry as to whether or not the enslaved Africans would then seize the opportunity to revolt, which is basically what happened in Virginia, in Georgia, etc.
And yet, what we know in terms of black folks and the War of 1812 is the story of those colored troops, that's the way they call themselves, who fought with Andrew Jackson in the Battle of New Orleans.
That's true, and that is a fact, and I have quite a bit of new evidence with regard to that. It's very curious. One of the most sustained and violent episodes of slave unrest took place in 1811 in Louisiana. In fact, Louisiana as a state probably has the broadest and deepest history of revolt against slavery by black folk than any other state in the so-called Union. And this slave revolt of 1811 was basically squashed, not least because of the assistance, I'm afraid, of so-called colored troops and militia who were enlisted on the part of the authorities. And the Battle of New Orleans, basically erupting at the end of 1814 and the beginning of 1815, not only saw the use of these colored troops on behalf of the Stars and Stripes, but also you should know that about maybe 10 to 15% of those fighting under the Union Jack, that is to say fighting with the British troops, were of African descent, mostly Jamaicans. Because you need to know that Africans in the hemisphere, and perhaps even worldwide, looked at the United States the way that we looked at apartheid South Africa in the 20th century. That is to say, it was like a holy crusade to oppose the United States of America by Africans worldwide, and particularly by those in the Caribbean. I talk in the book about a number of episodes where the slave masters of Virginia in particular were seeking to transport enslaved Africans to the newer territories, such as in Mississippi, for example, in the first few decades of the 20th century. You may know that Virginia, by the first few decades of the 19th century, it had basically become something of a breeding state, and I mean what I say there. That is to say, it was basically breeding Africans for export. And so what was happening is that they were trying to transport these Africans to Mississippi in particular. The problem was, how did you get those Africans to Mississippi? If you went overland, you had to face the prospect of rebellious indigenous people who did not necessarily cotton to the idea of these Euro-Americans traipsing across their territory. So they would try to do it by ship. But what happened is that sometimes the ships would be blown into Bermuda, for example, which is only a few hundred miles off the coast of the United States. And so what would happen is that the British, and particularly the Africans in Bermuda, would then clamor for these Africans to be free. Now, let's back up for a second and acknowledge that Britain in its colonies was a slave-owning power, but abolitionism sunk deeper roots in the British Empire than in the Republic, not least because this Republic, that is to say the United States of America, was basically born as a settlers' revolt in order to perpetuate slavery because they were afraid of the import and impact of abolitionism, particularly Somerset's case, which comes in June 1772 in London, which seems to suggest that abolitionism is going to be spreading across the entire import. And, of course, Somerset's case helps to light the fuse for 1776. I should also say that by the first few decades of the 19th century, the British were coming to rely very heavily upon African labor, and they were then worried that the European settlers would do a replay of 1776. And, of course, that was in the minds of these European settlers in Bermuda, for example, and in Nassau and the Bahamas, too, for that matter. So London was beginning to sideline and marginalize the European settlers in these colonies, which is why some of them then migrated to the United States. St. George Tucker, for example, who was a leading figure in Virginia in the early 19th century, particularly with regard to Gabriel's Revolt in Richmond in about 1800 in Virginia, was from Bermuda, as were a number of other leading figures. And so when these boats, these slave ships, would then be blown off course to Bermuda, the Africans would clamor for their release, and then Britain, which still had a bone to pick with the United States because they were still smarting from the revolt against British rule, and then the hubristic statements by the Republicans, that is, say, the U.S. Nationals, that they had discovered the secret to humanity and the secret to happiness by overthrowing British rule, this was a way to stick it to the United States. And this was a way to basically stir up controversy in the United States. And so they would oftentimes free these Africans, and this happened repeatedly. And so this was also helping to carry the favor of the enslaved Africans on North American soil. It's a well-known diplomatic tactic to carry favor with the dissidents of your opponent. I mean, for example, it's no secret, for example, that the United States got quite a bit of traction during the Cold War by appealing to those in the Soviet Union who had a bone to pick with Moscow. For example, these large campaigns on behalf of Soviet Jewry, which of course led to a major migration to Israel from Russia and helping to bolster, I'm afraid, the right-wing population of Israel. So London was attempting the same sort of maneuver by currying favor with these enslaved Africans in the states of the United States of America.
So as you explain it, Frederick Douglass's rebuke to the United States with his famous 4th of July address was actually speaking for the African diaspora, and his trips to Britain for fundraising and for agitation are certainly in context with this.
Not only that, but you need to realize, now buckle your seatbelts, Mr. Ford, and also a listening audience, the Africans did not see the revolt against British rule and the establishment of the United States as legitimate. Just as you have numerous Cuban Americans in Florida and in New York who did not see the revolution in 1959 as legitimate, which is why they don't see why the United States should recognize the state, well, Africans felt the same way about the United States of America. Now, let me step back for a second and put this in even a broader context. Another reason for to help shed light on what I'm talking about is the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804. The Haitian Revolution basically upset the calculus with regard to slavery, as I note in the book, and basically induces a general crisis of the slave system that can only be resolved with its collapse, which happens in the United States, 1861, 1865, with the U.S. Civil War, and 1888 with the final collapse of slavery in Brazil. What I mean by that is that 1791 to 1804, particularly the early years of the revolt against French rule in Haiti, you saw many of the major powers, including London, they sought to intervene against the Africans in Haiti. And London suffered one of the most ignominious defeats in its long history with its intervention against the Africans in Haiti. And after suffering that defeat, the Londoners, the elite of the British Empire, stepped back for a second, and they recognized that the jig was up with regard to slavery, not least because Haiti was quite close to Jamaica, one of the crown jewels of the British Empire, and that, like successful revolutionaries anywhere, the Haitians would try to spread their seditious message, not least in their own neighborhood. And so I quote at length from Londoners saying, wait a minute, the jig is up, it's time to reconfigure. You can draw a straight line from the Haitian Revolution to London moving to abolish slavery in the empire approximately three decades later. But the United States of America did not, perhaps at that moment, could not draw that conclusion, not least because they were born as a revolt against abolitionism, not least because, as noted, the most powerful state in the Union was Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's Virginia, and not least because a great deal, a disproportionate amount of the capital in the United States was embodied in the bodies of Africans. And so as London then accelerated its path towards abolitionism, with the Haitian Revolution, the United States dug in its heels. And then that led basically to collaborations between Port-au-Prince, that is to say Haiti, and Britain against the United States on many different levels, which I detail in the book. So the Haitian Revolution, it seems to me, as has been noted by many writers and analysts previously, was quite a boon to the abolitionist movement in the United States, which is why we still owe a major debt of gratitude to Haiti.
How much are the white settler revolt origins of the United States reflected in U.S. imperial policy today?
Oh, it's reflected all across the board. I mean, first of all, you have this idea, this mythology, which still is taught in universities, I'm afraid, of isolationism, of the Republic, and the Monroe Doctrine proclaimed by President James Monroe approximately 190 years ago, supposedly reflects this so-called isolationism. But actually, this isolationism had many different strands. First of all, the United States was basically consolidating its rule in North America, fighting indigenous nations, that's to say Native American nations, and therefore it wanted the Londoners to butt out, because there's another story to be told, and has been told to a certain degree, about how the Native Americans as well were collaborating with London against Washington. And I tell this story as it manifests itself in Florida, where you have some of the bloodiest wars the United States has been involved in its bloody history, the so-called Seminole Wars, three Seminole Wars, in fact, 1818, 1819, 1830s, and the 1850s, where you basically had Africans and indigenous people combining as one against the extension of Washington's rule in what is now the Sunshine State. Sadly, as we know, that did not work itself out. So, yes, it's very important to point out that this whole idea of isolationism was not only a way to allow Washington to continue its routing of Native American peoples, but also to keep London and other powers from interfering on behalf of Africans and on behalf of Native Americans. Because keep in mind that there's substantial contestation for North America. Somehow now, I guess we sort of see after the fact, sadly enough, that it was inevitable. It was far from inevitable. I mean, for example, Russia was involved on the West Coast. You know that the United States buys Alaska from Russia, 1867, Seward's Folly, it was called at the time, after Secretary of State William Seward, but actually, as is now recognized, it was really a steal, not to mention a travesty in terms of the rights of the indigenous people of Alaska. But even California, there was major contestation for California in the 1840s and 1850s, not only between the United States and Mexico, but also Russia and Britain. Indeed, one of the things I point out when I get to California history, after the defeat of Mexico in that war of aggression, 1846 to 1848, and then the discovery of gold in Northern California, the area around Sacramento, California, is that you had a major influx into Northern California from Australia, because it, in some ways, it was easier to get to California from Australia than to get to California from New York. I mean, you could just take a ship, straight shot from Sydney, whereas from New York, you'd have to fight Native Americans every step of the way. You have these Australians flooding in. They're being lynched by the Euro-Americans because they see them, correctly so, as stalking horses for London. Because there's a so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States today, people read that back, which is oftentimes what historians and, of course, non-historians do. But, of course, Britain in the mid-19th century was like the Al-Qaeda of today, in other words. It was a hated country, except by the Africans, who, of course, tended to be pro-London because they saw London as a standard bearer for abolitionism. So in any case, you also have the Negroes being lynched in Northern California. So what happens? Sir James Douglas, who is a man of color, who is the governor of what is now British Columbia, and indeed the founding father of British Columbia. One of the interesting aspects of this book, I think, is that because Britain had this far-flung empire and had a relatively small population, it had to rely more on Negroes to be administrators. I mean, you hardly have black governors today in the United States. I mean, Deval Patrick and who else, for example. But in British Columbia in the mid-19th century, you had Sir James Douglas. He makes an appeal to the Negroes of San Francisco to move northward, where he says you can vote. And in fact, the cover of this book is a picture of the Negroes from San Francisco who move to what is now British Columbia after the appeal of Sir James Douglas and take up arms on behalf of Britain and the British Empire, because, of course, Canada was part of the British Empire, at a time when relations between the British Empire and Washington were, of course, in its usual bad state. One of the larger takeaways, I think, that a reader should note from this book is that the dirty secret, as I put it, of the progress of people of African descent in the United States of America has been that we have made progress to the extent we have been able to stiff-arm and ignore U.S. sovereignty. Parenthetically, that's one of the reasons, I think, that our friends on the left missed the boat with the Battle of Seattle 1999, the anti-war Trade Organization protest, where part of the cry of some was that they felt the World Trade Organization was somehow detracting from U.S. sovereignty. As I said at the time, I'd rather take my chances any day. If I only have two choices, I'll take my chances with a faceless bureaucrat in Geneva any day than a faceless bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. I mean, that's been the lesson of our history. So that line about protecting U.S. sovereignty obviously needs to go into the trash heap of history. I mean, it's ludicrous.
And we can see a straight line from that attitude towards the United States and its claims as a nation being antithetical to black claims to humanity, a line straight to Malcolm X advocating that black folks in the United States treat the United States government as one would a foreign oppressor and bring it to the United Nations.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, there have been many episodes, fortunately, in the 20th century, trying to take the United States to the United Nations. This is why this book, I think, is probably going to get a better reception. As a matter of fact, it already is getting a better reception in Canada and London and Australia than in the United States, where I think it'll either be trashed or ignored, quite frankly. It's because it goes against some of the mythology. It goes against the creation myth of the United States, that it's born in this grand revolution. But also some of our friends on the left, I think, perhaps understandably, they painted this picture where they see themselves in many ways as, say, standing in the footsteps of Thomas Jefferson. You might recall the Jefferson School of Social Science of the 1950s, which was started by the Communist Party, where Lorraine Hansberry, the great playwright, basically received her political education, for example, named after Thomas Jefferson. And I think that many people on the left, they feel that they're marginal already. And so then to go against the creation myth of the United States will make them doubly and triply marginal.
And would this include Howard Zinn?
Howard Zinn, bless his soul. I respected Howard Zinn, and I think he did great work. And He's now sadly passed away, and I've tried to avoid saying anything that doesn't smile upon him, not least because he's not here to defend himself. But having said that, I have to accept the premise of your question. I mean, I think it sort of overstates the case. I mean, you get the idea that John Brown, the great Euro-American anti-slavery crusader who gave his life to help to free the enslaved, was sort of the rule. He was a distinct exception. But not only that, John Brown, as I point out in the book, basically he went to Europe, in fact to Britain, to confer with abolitionists before coming back to Harper's Ferry. A lot of the planning for Harper's Ferry, 1859, was done in Canada, which then became a target for the Confederate States of America during the U.S. Civil War of 1861-1865. Not only that, but I point to other Euro-Canadians, in fact, who in some ways outstrip Harriet Tubman, the great black woman rescuer of the enslaved, in terms of going into the South and rescuing slaves and bringing them back to Canada, for example. This is part of this conflict between the British Empire and the United States. And so, obviously, what I'm saying, I'm sure our friends on the left will not find it useful to their present struggles, but like the United States always tells other people, like they told the people in the Balkans in the 1990s, you know, you need to face your history. As bitter and as painful as it might be, you need to face it. Well, that's what I'm saying to these people of the United States of America. You need to face your history. Particularly, it's going to have to be faced because, as I said, this rise of China and the rise of Brazil and the rise of India is really going to cause a major psychic crisis in the United States. And so the better we face our history and get the true realities out, the more ahead of the curve we'll be.
Dr. Gerald Horn, and that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.